we all walked out of the theater super jazzed, and you're the one person who was like, you know what? Didn't like that.
I've been on this boat since Infinity War. I knew those movies were going to be bad as soon as they said we're doing part one, part two, and I was right at every turn.
They didn't listen to Cassandra either.
I am blessed with the gift of prophecy from Apollo himself when it comes to bad MCU decisions.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Overly Sarcastic Podcast. I am Blue, coming to you from not sunny, in fact, very dreary Florida. It is foggy and rainy, and I'm enjoying a hot cup of Earl Grey tea inside because it is one of the few teas that this Airbnb has. Red, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm enjoying an iced caramel macchiato, which does not reflect at all on the temperature on where I am. I just drink these things year-round. I'm a firm proponent of the idea that anything meant to be consumed cold is better consumed when it's cold outside, because then the thing doesn't melt. Ice cream in the winter slaps. Yeah. Anyway.
Oh, yeah.
Good work, team.
Yeah, no,
we really pulled this one together. All right, well, that's all we got for you this week.
Tune into the After Show. Catch you all on the Patreon bonus. Otherwise, yeah, good talk, team. 1-2-3 break. And we can all clock out and go get lunch.
Man, this job's easy. should I go first? I think my video went up first.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, so the video of mine that went up in the last 2 weeks was...
Is this the Sigma grind set? Is this what this is?
Oh, God. Maybe? I hope
Pretending
not,
like
though.
You're doing work and then not actually doing anything?
Oh, you know what? Yeah, absolutely. Hundo P.
Hundo P?
I've been saying that for weeks. Where have you been?
I'm blissfully ignorant, apparently. Red, I'm so sorry. Please tell us about The Last of Their Kind.
Yes, yes. My video for the last couple weeks was a trope talk on The Last of Their Kind, which was a funny one because I had to caveat the shit out of this one because it's really one of those tropes that is not what it says it is. And it really annoyed me the first time I was, like, working out the script for it, because I was like, if I limit myself to only talking about characters who are actually the last of their kind and stay that way through to the end of the story, it's going to be, like, two guys. and none of the most iconic examples.
It's Knuckles the Echidna.
It's just Knuckles the Echidna, because legally he's not allowed to have a family. That, oh, I didn't have it in me to do the full research I would have needed to do to bring up the Knuckles situation. Because it's so complicated. All I know is that, legally speaking, the rights to every other echidna in the Sonic universe belong to a guy who gets very litigious whenever Sega tries to put them in anything. So, legally speaking, Knuckles is always going to be the last echidna.
I love that for Knuckles.
It's so funny to me. But one of the things that I thought was really interesting about unpacking this bad boy was, like, how many cases it was where they were the last. They were the last for so long. And then a writer was like, I've got an idea. And bam, suddenly the continuity and the canon are completely changed. Yeah. It was very funny seeing how many, like, verbal backflips people were having to do to explain why Last Son of Krypton is totally still legit and actually makes sense. It's like, well, he's the last male child born on Krypton that survived. It's like, oh, come on. Semantics.
Yeah.
That's the letter of the law and not the spirit.
It really is interesting seeing how many situations there were where it's like, this was a full textbook last of their kind, and then a writer got ideas, because in terms of character arcs, it doesn't break anything. You can have a character go through they're the last of their kind arc, thinking they're the last of their kind, and just have that arc, and it's like, all right, what else can we do with this character? Upset the status quo. And then it's like, all right, well, I guess the next logical step is to introduce a bunch of other people. The Last of Us 2, turns out there were more of us than we initially thought.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really easy to do that once you've gotten over the hurdle of doing it once. Mm-hmm. I talked about Goku as kind of one of the classic examples, because it's like, initially, it doesn't really seem like he's the last of anything. He's just weird. And then it's like, oh, just kidding. There's actually, there was a whole planet of us, and it exploded, and now there's four of us. And then it's like, well, now there's two of us, and then there's back to three, and then it's down to two again, and it's just a whole thing. But after that, the non-canon movies started being like, here, more Saiyans, Broly and his dad.
Broly was so cool when I was like 12 years old and got the original, now non-canon DVD of the DBZ Broly movie.
Target audience acquired.
Yeah.
Turles, I want to say. I think that was the guy with the tree. There's just a bunch. And I think now there's like, oh, there's another universe where Planet Vegeta was never destroyed and there are just like billions of alive Saiyans there. And it's like, oh, cool. All right. Neat. Anyway, I don't know. I really haven't been keeping up on new Dragon Ball stuff, except for when they did Super Broly, because they were like, we're doing Broly but canon this time. And I was like, this I gotta see. And it slapped. It was really fucking good. Anyway,
nice.
I think I put a little bit of that in the video, just a smidge.
You mentioned non-canon and semi-canon, and you showed Broly beating up on Goku.
I had to pick exactly which part of that fight I wanted to include, because, oh, like, original movie, dumb as all fuck. I love it dearly, but it's so stupid. I like how Vegeta spends a solid 40 minutes being like, no, there's simply no point. He's too powerful. It's just, man, learn a new tune, bro. And then in Super Broly, they were like, we're going to pointedly avoid doing that.
Is that the one where the meme of, oh my god, he's so fucking cool comes
abridged Broly, yeah.
Good.
Yeah, where instead of just making Vegeta have an existential crisis, they just make him a huge Broly fanboy who then has an existential crisis because Broly's entire motivation is Goku's crib was next to his and Goku wouldn't shut up, so he's traumatized by the concept of Goku. Wait, oh boy. Super Broly's a good movie, and the choreography slaps. But anyway, I had a point at some point. The thing about the Last of Their Kind trope is, you're right, when you're expanding on a character like that's character arc, you're going to end up approaching the question, what does it mean for them to be last, and are they really the last? Which is why I kept looping back to that Superman the Animated Series episode where he goes out to the ruins of Krypton and is like, yep, as I thought, absolutely everybody is dead. And then it's like, just kidding, there's one left. But even then, like, I think that a lot of those cartoons kind of get, the horror gets glossed over because it's like, it's a happy, fun cartoon from the 90s. And it's like, this is Supergirl and her family. And they were all like, we're going to freeze ourselves in cryosleep and hopefully somebody finds us. And like 3 out of 4 pods failed. And her family is dead. And we do see their skeletons. And Clark is like, okay, let's bring her back to Kansas and hope she fucking defrosts okay. Oh, man. And one of the things that I think is very interesting about that example specifically is that Superman and Supergirl both have isolation stories that are completely different because Clark was raised on Earth and fundamentally he is a human, basically, to who does being Superman as a job. Whereas Kara was like, not an adult, but like sentient, like a full
person. She has memories of Krypton.
She has memories of, well, Argo City, depending on how they do it. It's like either it's a part of Krypton or it was like the sister planet of Krypton.
Oh,
or it was in the version in the comics, it was a chunk of Krypton that was flung loose when the planet exploded but managed to remain intact. But like every other part of Krypton, it started turning into kryptonite. So everybody on Argo City started dying and they were like, we can get our daughter out of here, but that's it. And they're like, we'll send her to this planet. And they're like, wait, there's a guy there flying around. What's the deal with that? And they're like, oh my God, that's your baby cousin Clark. This is great. We'll sew you a little outfit so he knows that you're family. All right, bye. We're going to go die now. See you later, sweetheart. And then she just jets off to Earth and she's like, yay, I've arrived on Earth. My entire family's dead, but I can't wait to really carry on the super legacy. It's like, boy, those comics were, a lot was going on at all times. But one of the things that's been interesting for them to explore is that, you know, Clark is fundamentally a very kind of, he's got his own complications, but he loves Earth and he feels very attached to it. Whereas for Kara, she's a lot less attached to it and she's a lot angrier about what happened. And I think that a lot of the stories explore that in interesting ways because they are kind of all that the other one has in that specific regard, but they are still quite separate from each other. One of the only things I liked about the New 52 Supergirl run is that when she first meets Clark, she finds it extremely suspicious that he speaks Kryptonian like he's reading out of a textbook. And she's like, this guy doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about. She's like, she's getting the uncanny valley from Clark.
Kal-El has this Rosetta Stone-ass accent that he's speaking with.
Exactly, yeah. So, I don't know. I think that there's a lot of very interesting angles to unpack there. One person in the comments I saw noticed that the way I used an example in DS9 was kind of the opposite of how it actually played out. Because the character from DS9 that I used for this example, Odo, he early on discovers, oh, there are more of my kind. Oh, they're the bad guys. Oh, they are the root cause of the evil empire we've been trying to stop. Ah, shit. And at the end of that episode, he's like, that's okay. You know what? I'm not going to join you guys. I'm going to go back and be with these people. And they're like, well, they don't really understand you. You know, the solids will never understand. He's like, that's okay. And then by the very end of the show, he's like, no, actually, I do need to rejoin the collective so that I can cure the plague, et cetera, Star Trek stuff, and teach them to not be xenophobic pieces of shit. And the odds are good that I will never come back. All right, bye, everybody. And it's like, I don't... I mean, it's sad. It's intentionally sad. Like, it's supposed to be, like, a bittersweet situation. Yeah. I just... I don't know. So I was using, like, the earlier example where he's like, I choose my family. And then at the end, he's like, nah, well, I also, it's, all right, well, it's been fun. Bye, guys. No, come on. The 2-minute unscripted Kung Fu Panda rant was my favorite part of that video.
Yeah, I, because that obviously wasn't in the script that you sent me. There was a little bit of it there. And I was like, wait a minute. I don't remember any of this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because
I'm like, also, her delivery is different. Like, you can tell, like, or at least I can tell, like, when yeah. we're reading off of a script versus when we're off the cuff. And I'm like, this is not the delivery of someone reading. This is, she's just going.
I'm just going. Yeah, yeah, because I reached the end of the bit I'd written about Kung Commander. I was like, you know, second movie, the last of their kind. Third movie, not the last of his kind. And I was like... Also, you know, Poe being raised, like, by people who don't understand him, that kind of is, like, the foundational tragedy of his character. And when you really think about it, and then afterwards, I was like, how much of this can I fucking keep? I don't know how much of that made any sense. I'm very glad people liked it.
It's very rare that we get something in the booth, so to speak, that ends up being an integral part of the video. That's essentially the whole detailed diatribe format. But with the actual, like, trope talks, it's like... If something sneaks its way in there, it really was just begging to be part of the video.
Apparently so, yeah. So that was a very... Apparently so, yeah. Wow. Okay, anyway, it was a good time. I had a lot of fun with it. I'm glad people liked it.
Yeah. My video for this week was kind of another version of this, where it was you and I chatting just off the cuff. You said, oh, I'm going to download the audiobook for The Art of War, and I scoffed and said, what, all 25 minutes of it? And then after a little bit of back and forth, I realized, wait a minute, I have thoughts on this. I need to check myself and probably do more research and actually make a video on this, because I have bits and I have thoughts, and those are where a good video script starts from.
Oh, yeah. It's always good, because I think every time we've been like, I don't know if there's anything really here, we always end up striking gold and going off on it. Yeah, it's always very fun. And Sun Tzu was an interesting one, because it's one of those cases where it's like, the advice is very real, but the guy, who the fuck knows?
Yeah, and it was really interesting seeing the response in the comments of people being like, this is baby mode, stupid nonsense that is completely insignificant, and, like, everyone would think this is obvious. And some comments are like, yeah, you know, it really goes to prove that saying that common sense is not as common as you would hope for it to be. Mm-hmm. And again, given the intended audience of, like, nobles and kings who've never actually stepped in mud before, it's like, yeah, you need to explain this stuff sometimes. Not to, like, completely babyify the people who were running China during the spring and autumn period and, like, paint a picture of them as being completely incompetent until someone like Sun Tzu rolls around. But, like, yeah, no, this was a... This was pretty transformative, and it's obvious now because we've been doing warfare forever, but in the first major period of, like, systematic, continuous, large-scale war, yeah, this stuff is going to be important, and it's going to be the first time this ever really comes up in academic discourse.
I think that people who assume that warfare being based on deception is baby mode, easy, obvious, maybe need to, like, question that statement, because, like, you're right. Obviously, we need to, you know... We need to account for the fact that most of these people didn't have context for, like, what actual warfare feels like. But, like, there is an underlying presumption of honesty that most people have very strongly underpinning the way their mind works.
Yeah.
You will assume that people are being honest with you. It often takes a lot of work to conclude, like, oh, this person was lying, or, like, oh, I've been scammed or something like that. That's why scams work. People presume honesty. I was actually just thinking about that. I guess, spoiler alert for an upcoming video, I was working on a script for Trickster Heroes. Because I got an ask on Tumblr that was like, do you have any thoughts on Trickster Heroes? And I was like, well, not that many. 8 paragraphs later. All right, shit, maybe. And Trickster Heroes, as I was kind of writing it out, I was like, you know what? This is all stuff that makes sense to me, but it doesn't come naturally to how I think. You know, I'm a very straightforward person, and I don't grok subtlety very well. So for me, the idea that, like, oh, you have a goal you want to achieve, and you will acquire it by being dishonest. I was like, that does make sense. but it wouldn't occur to me in isolation. And, you know, there are rules, there are principles of these things. It might feel kind of not cool to be like, I'm going to rock up to the battlefield with 1/10 of my enemy's force, and I'm going to make him think that I've got an equal army and scare him off. It's like, well, that's not exactly cricket, is it? I don't know if that's all right. And it's like, but that's the thing, you know, so you need to reframe your thoughts to understand when and how lying becomes the correct thing to do.
Well, the example that just clicked in my head like 20 seconds ago was literally the plot twist of the Trojan War is that all warfare is based on deception.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The Trojans didn't think anything was amiss except for Laocoon, but he was too pure and too plot savvy to be allowed
world.
To live.
Yeah.
Virgil's like, get the fuck out of here. You're so Smack. Dead, buddy. You're canceled.
Athena but... only allows one smart boy per 10,000 people.
Odysseus gets the brain cell for this war. But yeah, I obviously the like on paper, like practical warfare text was interesting to unpack and like what was the context in which this was written? Why was this transformative as opposed to just like, I mean, well, duh, buddy, everyone knows that. If it was really that obvious and like unnecessary to write down, then it wouldn't have had this textual tradition behind it, but there's obviously a lot of stuff militarily going on there and organizationally and strategically, but what really made it click for me was when I was researching and stumbled into this one line about like, yeah, you know, there's this idea of like parsimonious strategy where you're really like using as few resources as possible, which parallels Chinese rhetoric where you're trying to use as few words as possible. And I'm like, excuse me, what? So I started digging into that, read this research paper from, I forgot what the year was, I think I put it in the description, but a research paper from sometime in the past, like 10, 20 years. I'm like, yeah. So it's like this whole connection of the art of war is just another application of Taoism and that philosophy really pulled everything together in a way that made it work. It's like, oh, yeah, you know, if you're a white boy in business school, you're not going to get what's happening here.
No.
Yeah. Oh, there really is an essential context to the culture that you deeply needs to know implicitly if you're going to have any sense of actually making this book work. Cool. So I'm glad I was able to find that. I knew there was more, and I knew there was this strategic element that was kind of glossed over of like, oh, this advice is dumb. But after I unpacked that, I'm like, I've got some space left in the script. What else can I find? And I stumbled onto this Taoism angle, and I'm like, oh, this is it. This is what makes it make sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's very rare that I get one of those true eureka moments, because I knew going into the video, like, okay, there's more to the strategy, but I did not expect to have that realization. So that was really, really exciting to stumble into as I was working on and then being able to incorporate that into the script. So
yeah.
Got to have another episode of my Blue has a strong take and proves himself wrong through good academic practice. I like this narrative that I'm developing this year. I've really enjoyed the videos we've had so far because it's just been like, Blue has a hot take. He researches it and realizes that he's not strictly wrong, but there's more to it than that.
Punished Blue. Yeah. Return from the front trying to figure his shit out. Oh, man. It was very interesting, though, because in, you know, obviously most of my exposure to, like, Chinese history has been through literature, Journey to the West, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
When you unpack that, it's like, oh, it's all allegories for Taoism, Buddhism, all the competing philosophies that were going on at the time. In fact, it's extremely unsubtle propaganda in most places. But like, when you sort of unpack, like, oh yeah, this is kind of a cultural context where it sort of seems like the philosophy and the philosophical debates of the day really get everywhere. Like, because you were comparing it a little bit to like Greek philosophical debate, which really seemed like it was kind of the territory of the guys without a lot else going on in the day, you know? It was kind of a...
Yeah.
In the same
old
way that,
man,
like...
arguing.
Yeah, well, in the
you
same way...
You are nitpicky and biased. I win. Bye-bye.
In the same way that, like, polymathy was a privilege of the people with a big pile of money and no other needs, you know? Like, people who spent a lot of time thinking about thinking because they didn't have anything else going on. Whereas this kind of approach, it sort of feels like, no, philosophy, it's not separated out from the way you live a life, you know, day to day. Obviously, emperors and generals and armies is not like the day to day living of your average, you know, citizen. But it does kind of indicate like this wasn't partitioned out from the way that, you know, the way that everybody lived. It's like these are sort of axioms of existence, and this is what happens when you try to apply them to a conflict. And it turns out works pretty well.
Yeah.
just like the simple concept of like know when to fight and when not to fight. That applies everywhere. And yeah, that's because it's really basic advice. But it's only basic if you already know it, you know?
Yeah. So. And it's the kind of thing that it's easy to hear but hard to internalize.
Oh, yeah.
You can hear all warfare is based on deception, but actually being good at it is another matter entirely. You can hear don't let your mind play tricks on you and rush you into stupid decisions. It's another thing to not be tempted by what seems like an easy win, and then it's like, oh boy, my enemy has no soldiers right there. I'm going to go charge into this narrow ravine, and it's like, why are there arrows blotting out the sun?
You can hear if your opponent is of choleric temperament, seek to anger him, and think, huh, wonder who that's for. Anyway, let's go crush my enemies. Like,
I would simply not be of choleric temperament.
Yeah. When I'm angry, it's for damn good reasons. It is funny to me, however, it's like, it's so obvious, and it's like, there's a reason the Battle of Agincourt is like the one thing that people know about, that like people cite, because it was clever and tactically complicated and not just two armies on a big open field. Let's see whose power level is higher. Like, Warfare is potentially infinitely complicated, but a lot of the people in charge of it want it to be simple.
Yeah.
Or rather, again, because of the trickster heroes thing I was talking about, most of the antagonists in those situations will attempt to define the terms of the battle on a thing they will automatically win. Like, brute strength, because I am the strongest. Or, like, political power and money, because I'm the richest. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, when faced with that, the person has to change the terms of the battle. And that means everything that goes in the art of war, you know?
Yeah.
All the tricks to change the game.
Yeah. Once you know what you're looking for, it is a transformationally different read. So do go pick up a copy from your library. It's short. You can hammer that bad boy out in a quick evening if you want. But it's,
I let my hold lapse, so I'm going to need to pick it up again. Fortunately, I don't think the line is very long.
Yeah, it's 25 minutes a pop, basically. No,
yeah, I changed my mind about it and just went back to listening to the Andy Serkis Hobbit again, so, you know.
There's some riddles in the dark. All riddles are based on... I don't know. There's a connection there.
Something in its pockets is precious.
Yeah, exactly. Bilbo is a trickster hero. Anyway, those were our videos. We do hope you enjoyed them. We had fun making them, as we always do on this channel. But
yeah.
Three quick things to announce. One is on Friday, we're going to be opening up our vault of merch for the spring cleaning sale, which is very exciting. So if you missed any pins... if you missed plushies or anything like that, you want to go grab that. They will be up for 2 weeks. We'll also have some general sales, I think. I'm not sure what the percentages are yet. Figuring that out this week. Mm-hmm. Check out our merch store, overlysarcastic.shop, for that. We also have a special Percy Jackson-themed bonus podcast episode with Mike from Newest Olympian and Dominic Noble. That'll be up next week, usual time. And then finally, later this month, the end of March, we will be at PAX East in Boston doing a community meetup on Thursday the 21st, 6 p.m. in the community room on the first day of the con. Come say hi to Red Cyan and I. It'll be a good time. We hope to see you all there.
Yeah.
Other than that, we can hop on over to the Q&A portion of the podcast.
Yeah.
Hello and welcome to the Q&A portion of the Overly Sarcastic Podcast, where we answer your questions from Ask OS Pod on Discord. This first question comes from one of our lovely, lovely patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, support the channel, consider becoming a patron for a chance to have your question read first on a future episode. This question comes from Bill Vusay. To all three of you, if you had a circle of Dante's hell made especially for you, what would it be?
Ooh. We're making a new one rather than just like picking one that exists. Okay.
Custom design the circle of hell that would be the worst for you personally to be stuck in.
We also need to figure out what our mortal sins are that would land us there. This is a complicated question.
Well, we got to remember that Dante liked to paint with a broad brush, so anything that gets us sent to hell, it shouldn't be like he didn't do personalized punishments for anybody. The closest he got was like, and this politician I don't like is headfirst in a pit of tar being poked by demons.
It was really the popes that he was after specifically.
Yeah, it was very like mechanized. So I think it would need to be some kind of category. I think we would be unjustly put in the circle for online influencers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
That's,
I don't know if I agree with the sentiment that being an influencer inherently gets you stuck in a special circle of Dante's Inferno.
I don't agree with it either, but Dante was that kind of guy.
No, you know, having browsed TikTok once or twice, I do agree with that sentiment. My sin is that I think that OSP is the only morally just channel on the internet.
Indigo, everyone else, who works for several awful. Other people on the internet, will remain silent in this matter.
My other sin is that I make way too sweeping generalizations. I'm not prepared to back up with evidence. No. There are a lot of really great people out there, obviously.
This is like, yeah. Like a good chunk of our friend group is people who work in this weird field. We're talking about like Dante, you know, famously.
I don't disagree
rather
with you on the Dante front of it all. Yes, I think that there's a world where you can build an if we're building the modern Dante's Inferno, this is probably a class of people in society who are achieving like universal Dante's ire in the same way that the Popes all did, you know, like it's just a category.
I think we're just reinventing the College Hell video from First Principles.
Yeah, basically.
But influencer circle. I think that, that feels like a variant on Vanity. What was the thing for Vanity again? That was like Circle 2, because that's where you put all the hot ladies and also Achilles.
I mean, just from like podcaster POV on that, having to listen to your voice for the first time on a recording is a circle of hell on its own. And so there is a world where I'm like, what would be really bad is to somehow remove everyone's built up like lack of shame over the way that their own voice sounds and just force them to listen to recordings and recordings of them like flubbing takes over and over again.
Yeah, that actually
interspersed with all of your earliest videos or art that you've ever made.
Permanently
just shown
forced
to you.
Relive the first thing you ever made and published online. And
Yeah, definitely. I think you could also, in the same sense that, like, sometimes I have, like, nightmares that function like this, where you're trying to do a thing, and it's like, I've got it, and you, like, look back over it to see if it's right, and for some reason it's just all fucked up in some weird way. It's like, you can't, like, read or write in dreams. Like, I'll try to type it, and I'll be like, it's misspelled so weirdly. Let me try again. What the fuck happened? Why is it still wrong? Like that, but with, like, video editing. It's like, I flubbed this how did I forget this entire line? Why does my voice sound like that in this one? Like, that kind of thing. You're stuck in like edit hell.
My day-to-day inner monologue editing videos from people. I'm like, did they not send me a file, or is this line fully missing, or was it cut on purpose? What's happening? No one told me any information. I can't record this myself. I have in the past, before I learned better, been so sinful as to remove hard drive before hitting safely eject hard drive back when I was in like high school, back in the olden days, but still. So there's a circle of hell where my feet and hands permanently feel the fuzz of, like, you need more blood, because that's probably what those... That's what I imagine it feels like to those hard drives when they get forcefully ejected.
Your hard drive has circulation issues?
Yeah. That's the like, closest parallel I can think of in my head. Like, how would a human unsafely eject hard drive? Fuzzy hands.
All right, sure.
I'm no Dante.
I think
I don't personally
like,
think I should be in a hell of my own torment forever.
There's probably some, like, getting a hard drive ripped out before you safely eject is like having the wind just yanked out of your lungs all at once, and you have to be like, to get it back.
You're
that's
on an episode of Wipeout,
fuel-y.
And you keep going onto those,
that's
like,
a little too nightmare fuel-y. Then I probably shouldn't say the thing I was thinking about.
But needless to say, if you're trying to torture OSP forever eternally, circles of hell, don't get any ideas.
Just rewatch that College Humor Goes to Hell series. That was really funny.
That was pretty good, yeah.
Dante would also probably come after me for my strong pro-Venice bias. Even though I still like Florence, the fact that I'm a Venice fanboy at all is like, pick a side, dude.
Blue's innate knowledge of Italian history makes him the biggest target out of the three of us for Dante, just on familiarity alone. Like, Red and I got no skin in this game, you know?
Contempt.
I established in my Leading Tower of Pisa video that I'm a fervent pro-Guelph fanboy, but I also have to make sure that I'm the right kind of Guelph, because there were two different factions within that, which is what got Dante banished. So me being the wrong kind of Guelph is what's going to get me done in.
People have so many different reasons Dante could put me in hell recently. This is crazy. I gotta rewatch the most recent video. Well, this next question comes from Boshwa to all. What is the process between uploading a video and then recording a podcast episode? From my POV as a simple listener, it always seems really fast.
Well, on Friday, we upload a video, and then on Monday, we record the podcast, and then whoever's video was further away has a two-week gap in between.
That's basically it. It's like a two-week cycle for us, and then usually we record the episode, like, 2.5 days before it goes up on Wednesday mornings, and then I edit the next day, and then boom, podcast.
It's fluctuated over time. We had different recording days at different times, depending on our schedules.
It's always been within, like, a couple-day window, though, for the most part, with the exceptions of, obviously, like, we're traveling and stuff, but generally, that's the flow. Nice thing about podcast episodes is they don't have video, so really easy for me to edit really quickly, which is why we can have that kind of smaller window. If this was like a full video, obviously it would take longer. That's the bonus episodes.
Yeah.
Right, you had something you wanted to say?
Oh, I mean, because my videos often get scheduled a little bit further in advance. For me, it's like, what went up and when, how many weeks ago did I finish it? But usually, you know, it's gone up recently enough that it's like fresh in my mind again. And it's fun to talk about like the research process and what I was thinking when I finished it versus how the response was.
And I usually pull questions the day we record, so they're as fresh as possible. This is not always 100% true, depending on schedule stuff, but almost always Monday mornings, I'm pulling questions. Sucks if your questions went up on a Tuesday. I'm so sorry to you. But we got more questions to get to. Speaking of, this one coming
from
Dragon.
That's going to change the question asking meta pretty substantially.
Maybe just led you a little too inside baseball on that one, but oh well. It's fine. Giving you guys the secrets, the inside of the trade, as it were. This next question comes from Dragon Rider 323. To Blue, have your drawing skills improved at all since the infamous Les Mis video?
Oh God, no! Absolutely not. No. My eye as an artist and my ability to create things with the help of technology has improved. Also by staying in my lane and not drawing. I can make things that are beautiful, like the maps, like the little icons I do, some little graphic design stuff. Graphic design is my passion. But I know where my skills can take me, and I go no farther. So I've gotten a lot better at working within the constraints of my feeble mortal hands, trusting myself to mostly design work rather than actual, like, fine art in the traditional sense. So my drawing has not improved in the slightest. If anything, it's probably atrophied with more time since, like, middle school and high school art classes. I've gotten better in other things. I've gotten a comfortable sense of how my videos look, what the visuals that go into that will look like, how I can structure things, how I can make things flow nicely and have a really good sense of pacing and construction, so the audience feels like they are being kind of whisked along a narrative as opposed to having to do all this hard work of like, what am I looking at and what is this? So making things flow nicer is my kind of editing artistry that I do, and that is distinctly separate from any kind of drawing or painting or anything of the sort.
Yeah. Graphic design and figure drawing are two different skills, and you can be really good at one and not as great as the other. And I think you have a very nice sense of graphic design. Yeah.
Thank you.
Maybe Red has a better sense of figure drawing than you do.
Oh, yeah. Let me draw a chapter of Aurora. It'll take 17 years, and it will be a nightmare. This will be like the reverse of the My Immortal 1 chapter that's written really well.
Oh, yeah, the hacking chapter. Yeah. I've been watching so many, like, Strange Eons videos about My Immortal recently, and I think I have to recant my previous statement that it had to be satire. I genuinely now think that fanfiction was real, and so was the hacking chapter.
Oh, no.
The layers. The complexity.
Well, we'll get into something much less complex. Another question. This one comes from Tech Priest Chungus. For both, are there any pieces of media that are universally beloved that you personally cannot stand?
I mean, nothing is universally beloved. The internet has made that abundantly clear.
Yeah.
Let's say popularly beloved. Majority of people who have consumed it probably liked it. It was talked about well in the general zeitgeist, that sort of deal. I know that the exactitude of the word may not apply, but I think it's fair to say that there are pieces of media that people generally tend to like.
Yeah.
Well, I've got a scorching hot one.
Hit me.
I mean, maybe we should ease into it, but I've not been, like, quiet about this, but I've been disappointed with Endgame since before Endgame came out.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing is, like, there are a lot of people whose opinions I really respect who are like, oh, it was a beautiful way to finish off, like, the golden age of the MCU. And it's like, was it? Was it really? It had one of these things, which I like to call Schrodinger's bad writing, where Infinity War made a bunch of decisions where I was like, okay, if they set this up so that they can fix those in Endgame, this was a good way to build tension. Like, the interesting characters that they killed off. They killed off Loki, they killed off Black Widow, they killed off Gamora. I was like, those were three very stupid decisions. I'm excited to see what they do with them. And what they did with them was try really fucking hard to recover from the fact that they didn't fix them. Because they're like, don't worry, we'll do the Loki series with 2012 Loki. He's had all his character development poured into his head through a video montage, and now he's just like the Loki that you remember, only he hasn't actually done any of those things that you remember him doing. And Black Widow, we get one movie, and Gamora, we do the exact same trick. You get 2014 Gamora, but without any of her character development. I still haven't seen Guardians 3 because I've heard really good things about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'd probably enjoy it. I just have no reason to believe that anything that happens in it will matter in the grand scale without getting rebooted or reset because they want to put the X-Men in. And Endgame did a lot of things I liked. I was glad that they let Cap use Mjolnir. I thought the big on your left scene was very fun. I also really like that one edit that goes around online where they just keep bringing in more people.
Yeah.
Where it's like, we got all the X-Men, the Power Rangers, here's Gandalf. It's like, yeah, perfect. This is what I wanted. There's a lot that I enjoyed about that movie. There's a lot that I thought was fucking stupid. And the fact that, like, the current phase of the MCU has no goddamned idea what to do and no idea who to make the main character is because they got rid of all of their main character candidates at the end of that movie. They were like, Tony Stark is dead. Captain America did some shit that feels like character assassination to me, but whatever. And now he's never going to participate again. And Thor, well, we turned him into a punchline for the entire movie and then we handed him over to Taika Waititi. So who the fuck knows what's going to happen with Thor? And it's just like, cool, all right, this feels like a shambles that's like just barely making it over the finish line. But the music was good and the effects were good and it had a few bits of like powerful fan service that people liked. So everyone loses their minds over it. And I'm just like, I wish I could enjoy this movie as much as you guys did. I'm sorry that I can't, but it really feels like there are some very foundational problems with it that make it not a very satisfying conclusion. And what we're seeing now is mostly holdover problems from that. Like, that was supposed to be the end, and then they didn't let it end. But also, they didn't want to commit to it being the end, because it was making them a gazillion dollars a year. So that's why everything that's been happening in Phase 5 has been an absolute nightmare. I suppose. There's a reason I haven't been keeping up with it, because I decided, for self-care reasons, I was going to watch things I liked instead.
That last part is not true. You do not always watch things you like.
Well, not always, but I decided I was going to watch things that make me feel something, at least.
Yeah, no. I'll
rather than mild contempt.
I will say, Indigo, to set up what you might be about to say next, is that we all walked out of the theater, all like the Greens and the whole gang from college fencing days. We all walked out of the theater super jazzed, and you're the one person who was like, you know what? Didn't like that.
I've been on this boat since Infinity War. I knew those movies were going to be bad as soon as they said we're doing part one, part two, and I was right at every turn. I don't care if the internet gets mad about me. I am blessed with the gift of prophecy from Apollo himself when it comes to bad MCU decisions. I like Marvel characters. I like a lot of superheroes. I'm a big X-Man fan, so you can imagine that I'm excited to see the X-Mans getting some love. But fan service does not make a movie coherent or good, and as cool as it is to see someone wield Mjolnir or whatever, and this is not shade to you, Red, this is to the wider internet, because I agree with you that Endgame is bad. But
I didn't think it was shade of me.
But, like, seeing someone wield Mjolnir does not excuse not writing a coherent story within your script. Like, tell me, sit down and tell me the arc, excluding not taking into account other movies, meaning Endgame or Infinity War. The arc of a single one of those movies. It's just, they're not constructed like a movie. They're like a three-part TV event that should have aired back to back. And so, like, no, I'm not going to sit down and watch 6 hours of mush just because it's the capstone of these movies that were good to okay for like 5-6 years. Like, no, no.
I'm trying to remember what video it was in. It was one of the detailed diatribes where I like sat down and traced out Captain America's theoretically character arc throughout the movie.
I want to say that was the superheroes in Empty Worlds.
I think it was, because they kept starting an arc for him. It was like, what role does the man out of time play in this modern world? And then
none.
They never came up with an answer, because they every time they were like, maybe we can make him lead the Avengers like a good leader, they were like, but Tony has to be the specialist boy. So it just, he didn't have anything to do, to the point where his retirement left absolutely no impact on the world. And it's like, that feels wrong, really wrong. And it's indicative of a greater structural problem in the way those movies were laid out, which is they didn't really have much of an overarching plot beyond, we have to get to Infinity War and Endgame. Yeah. We need Thanos, we need the stones. So everyone's character arcs were just kind of like whatever the person writing the movie thought of. So like Winter Soldier, I still think Winter Soldier is at this point the best thing the MCU has done. It peaked there because it had a coherent theme of trust, and it had an actual answer for, like, why does Captain America need to be in the modern world? Because Captain America is not super fucking jaded, and he's like, I don't think we should have a surveillance state with orbital guns that can just take out enemies of the state. I think this is fucked, Mr. Fury. I think we should probably not do this. Like, that's an important role for him to play. And then after that, it was like, we got nothing. He got a beard now. He looks really good, doesn't he? Look at that. Wow.
Not to, like, damn, continue opening the Duncan on the MCU can of worms, even though it is my favorite thing to do. But, like, something that I thought was really impressive about phases 1 and 2 was how they mirrored comic book release scheduling in how they released movies, but doing these, like, individual runs that would lead up to a big team up. And, like, so you got individual heroes that you were invested in, and then the big team up issue, the big crossover eventually. But the problem that they started to run into when they got further and further is that works really well for comic books, a thing that you can read at your own pace and probably in less than an hour. And they entered into the realm of cinematic movies. An hour and a half to 2 hours on average in our modern day. Sometimes they're even pushing 2.5, which is far too long. That's a lot more of a buy-in to ask of a person to not only watch that the first time, but to watch it and internalize it enough that you understand every subsequent reference to it that pops up in media. And because you can't just go back and, like, cross-reference like a comic book would in seconds. Like, oh, I think it's on this page. Read the line. Great. Mm-hmm. You have to exit the theater, you have to go online, you have to use your keyword searches to find the exact clip from the exact movie to reference the line that you're thinking of to understand a thing that happened in a movie 5 years later. It doesn't hold up long term. They needed to adjust strategy by the time they got to Infinity War and Endgame to make these movies continuously comprehensible to audiences. And, like, people are talking about it now because they're in phase 5 or whatever, and it's become complete and utter mush. But, like, I'm telling you, back in phase 2, they should have switched up that strategy, because it was downhill for a while.
I really think that a large part of what's been throwing them for a loop is the same thing that's been harming comics as a whole, which is too many cooks. You got too many cooks, and they're all disagreeing with each other. And it's really hard to write a coherent character arc or a coherent narrative if you're entire team is changing between every project, because then things that get planted in one thing don't get paid off, and things come out of absolutely nowhere because the new writer's got a new vision that does not build off of anything previous. And the earlier phases were better about this because they weren't scrambling quite so much. Like, they had the audience
less constraining their choices.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. But also, they had the audience locked in until Infinity War and Endgame. That's probably why they split it in two. They were like, who the fuck is going to watch Infinity War and then not come back for Endgame? Yeah. Like, we're going to make bank on this. But, like, that's the thing. Everything they'd been doing was building up towards Thanos. After Winter Soldier, they basically decided that's the only thing we're going to be setting up. It's all going to be Thanos. All the Thanos setup, Power Hour, everything is an Infinity Stone, and everyone is working for Thanos. Cool. All right, fine. That makes the world feel incredibly tiny, but that's a really good way to build up to your grand finale. And then they were like, no, come back. We've still got more. Aren't you invested in the Eternals? And most people went, who? And it's like, So like, they knew that they had us on lock for that early part. And the fact that Endgame disappointed me, like, I liked parts of it. It was fan service. Lots of things went pew. When Captain Marvel flew through that ship, I was like, the movie could have been just that, and I would have been happy. I don't care. I love it when a character is just so much more powerful than everyone around them, and everybody knows it. It's my favorite episode of Justice League, or my favorite part of an otherwise mediocre episode of Justice League is when it's like, oh, the superheroines have been mind-controlled to all fight each other, and they're like, all right, we'll all snap each other out of it. Let's get out of here. And then Wonder Woman turns up, and they're all immediately like, oh, okay, the game has changed. Now we just need to try really hard to not die. Like that, I love that trope. They did it in Endgame, I liked it. But I think on a whole, the movie does not hold up, and it was a sign of the problems that are now writ large, that now it has become the popular position to be like, wow, the MCU really fell off. And it's like, it was bad before.
No, it's just we were down here in the trenches holding down that opinion when y'all said, this has been
destroying
crazy.
Yeah, we were disliking it before. It was cool.
Our mutual friend, Austin, is probably going to be so mad at me listening to this DM of Rolling with Difficulty because we argued so much about the quality levels of the MCU back in college, and I've been holding this down since day one.
Yeah.
But no, I think you're right. Endgame is very emblematic of the issues. You know, for me personally, like, I think that Infinity War and Endgame do a terrible job of understanding the idea of, like, shock and twists versus, like, suspense and excitement. Like, none of the action is memorable enough that I want to go and rewatch it like I would with, like, a martial arts flick that I really like, where it's got interesting blocking.
Well, you don't like the shot where they're like, she's not alone, and it pans over all 10 of their female
I groaned
leads.
Audibly in the theater. So I watched Infinity War with a bunch of college friends, but I watched Endgame while I was in Shanghai, China, which meant that it was an interesting experience. I'm like, what kind of crowds is this going to get out here? Like, is anything going to be cut from it? And nothing was. It was just like the English version of it. But I heard that happened in theaters, and it took all of my willpower to not audibly go like, ugh. But, like, yeah, there's an art to making a movie that's rewatchable and not beyond just how they fit into the MCU. Infinity War and Endgame don't even function as, like, standalone movies that understand, like, movie making, good storytelling, and rewatchability. Like, it's so, it's emblematic of that Game of Thrones final season era of, like, we just need to do things that are shocking so that people won't expect things. Like, it's the worst of the anti-spoiler culture era. And, like, we've kind of moved away from that a little bit, but still, like, that was its peak. And I think that's part of why it just...
Yeah,
I don't want to comment on this entire question to just say that Indigo was right and the MCU maybe made some mistakes in like the 2010s. So, Blue, do you have any media property?
I will say before I give mine that the circumstances of it is 2019, and the three things that have just ended this year are Game of Thrones, The Avengers, and Star Wars Episode IX. The Avengers sits pretty nicely in that pile. That's a strong first place finish in
the same
comparison.
Way that we look back on like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and like the Avengers and like Serenity and Firefly as like a certain era of Whedonism. I think we're gonna look back on that era of like finale franchises as a very particular point of time, and I don't think they're gonna age well.
No.
It's interesting. Yeah. Two out of three of them, I think, were just burying themselves in attempted fan service. And then the third one was just like, we want to get this over the finish line so we can move on to projects that aren't Game of Thrones. But
I know,
like,
they're making House of the Dragon, and the first season was pretty good.
I've heard the House of the Dragon's pretty good.
I don't think you, Red, would like it, but I do think it is
certainly
doing good things.
Yeah, but again, of that pile of things, I think the only one that it's controversial to be like, I don't think this was good is Endgame. Because, like, I think that Endgame... A lot of work is being done on Endgame's behalf by how bad everything since then has been received. Because people are like, oh, the golden age, the glory days. It peaked at Endgame. It's like, it peaked at Avengers 2012, and really it peaked in Winter Soldier, and we all know
it. It's a shame, because there's been some good things after it. Like, I like Shang-Chi, all right. I think the last third of it was pretty weak, but, like, I still enjoyed it well enough, and it stands
on
its own.
I'll watch that boss fight.
Yeah, no, I liked it. I'm a big martial arts cinema fan, so I was disappointed the finale of it wasn't like a one-on-one big martial arts duel. But for what it was, I enjoyed it well enough. And I really like the Guardians of the Galaxy movies. I thought 3 was a nice ending. But what makes those unique is that those have had one director and like really one team all the way through. They did the three movies they wanted to do, and now he's fucking off to go do DC's shit. So, like, it felt more planned. Like, the stuff that is working for them is not because of Endgame and Infinity War. It's in spite of it.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. So...
And there's...
Woof, we're going to get some strongly worded replies on this one.
You can at me about this, because genuinely,
I assure you, I've seen all the takes. But feel free to add and to go about it.
There's also a lot to be said for the multiple hits to Disney's strategy of, we're starting phase four, we don't really have a plan. It's like the writer and actor's strike now. Mm-hmm. And then also we are just trying to slop the fuck out of Disney Plus to create content to consume on that platform. And it's the same problem that affected Star Wars to varying degrees. Andor good, Book of Boba Fett very bad. It's astonishing they came out in the same year. I think they came out in the same year, yeah. It's rough. It's rough being a Marvel fan nowadays. We had it the best in Daredevil season 3, and it will never be that good again.
What do you mean? They're making more Daredevil. Isn't that what we wanted? More of the thing that we used to like?
I'm not going to get hurt by this
this
conversation.
This was not going to be my answer to this question. I was going to say the Dune movies only because I think that they are well-made, good movies that I just personally don't click with because I find them a little boring. And so I acknowledge that I'm definitely wrong about this, but they're the thing that everyone likes that I don't care for. Yeah. But
that's
Blue,
fair.
What was
I'm
your
planning
answer?
I'm watching Dune Part 2 soon.
Dungeons & Dragons, just conceptually.
I don't
like tabletop role-playing games as much as I want to, and I want to like playing them, but playing D&D, I think the mechanics are just so slow and just tedious to play through, and I know a lot of people are going to be like, oh, like, play 3.5. I'm like, oh, the game that's crunchier and slower and has more bullshit going on at the back end? Yeah, that's gonna solve my problem with it. Like, I want to like role-playing games, but I just have such a hard time getting into them and feeling like I am doing anything in these games because the nature of the play involves a lot of, you try to do a thing, it fails. You roll, it misses. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not gameplay. I want to like watching Critical Role. I tried. I don't. I love Vox Machina. Yep. I love the idea of the story, the animated one, but it's just playing Dungeons & Dragons, I just cannot like, and I'm glad people enjoy it, but it is so abundantly not for me, and I wanted to like it, and I thought, I was like, oh, I have a problem with like my character and the role in this campaign or like how something is structured. It's like, no, I just don't like this game. And that's okay. That's fine.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, it's completely fine. Games are meant to be fun. If you're not having fun, just don't play.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure we could try and sit here and recommend to you like one page TTRPGs and stuff that are a lot like rules light, easy to play, not 3.5.
I'll just turn my sister loose on you one of these days.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of what happened when we did the TTRPGs that aren't in D&D. I was like, oh, these are a bunch of really cool games. I have no excuse to play any of these.
You know what might be good for you is people make like journaling games. Like one player,
yeah,
you
like,
just
like
sort of
player.
Do. Those might be up your alley because they're typically pretty rules light. And it's just more like guided writing. But
I'm
valid.
I'm
valid
the kind
is
of player who doesn't like to find the fun for myself. It's like, it's Minecraft. Mm. It's a whole world. I'm like, give me the gameplay. Don't make me make the game fun. The game should be fun. Yeah. So that's why I like
why
board games a lot more
here?
Than TTRPGs.
Yeah.
Ooh, we are exact opposite kinds of people when it comes to physical games.
That is okay.
That's okay.
Wow, world's truly beautiful.
We got time, I think, for one or two more quick questions. I will not apologize for being so upset about how much people told me I was wrong for disliking Endgame, but I'm glad that, Red, you've organically given me an excuse
before
to be mad
we
about
move
it.
On. Before we move on, I will say this. If you wonder what the After Show is like and you're not a patron, that's the After Show basically that. Every single time. So if you're a patron, go watch the After Show or listen to it right now on our Patreon. And if you're not a patron, this is what you're missing. This is essentially what it is. There's your free trial.
Yeah. But sometimes we talk about things we like, so
true.
You know.
I've got some video game stuff in the back pocket for this one. So if you're curious, now's the week for video game stuff. But this question comes from LeFay's Chronicle. To all, this hit me out of the blue, but I have a rabbit plush named Usagi Yojimbo, and I was curious if you guys still have stuffed animals. And if so, are they named after someone or something?
Yes, tons. I have far too many. For years and years, they were like the standard gift that I would receive at holidays, so they always just kind of appeared on my bed or got like mashed between bed and wall. I have a lot of them. Almost none of them have names. I think the only one that I named anything was the first stuffed toy I ever had. It was this little pink teddy bear that I called Pink and Poofy. And it had like this very kind of like crisp fabric-y feeling that was always cool to the touch. Sensory, I loved it. had a bunch of other stuff. Currently, the only stuffed toy I have in my current point of residence, well, the only one that has the honor of being on the bed, is this big stuffed seal I got that's basically just an emergency second pillow. And I've got this little corgi in a bee costume that just kind of lives on my couch.
It's good.
Yeah.
It's good. Yeah. I've got a handful between Cyan and I. There's an abundance of stuffies out and about. One that I got for myself in college was from like the little TY plushies section at CVS. It was like a little gray owl that I named Bubbo after the Clash of the Titans owl. We have another one that's pink. It's the same owl but pink, who's named Bella. We have the Plague Doctor plush and the Plague Nurse plush. We call them Sneezy and Freezy. We've got a little Eevee named Jojo. There's a big owl pillow that doesn't have a name. There are a bunch of larger and smaller ones that are kind of out and about. But yeah, no, there's tons. Sometimes we'll just like, it's a night where we just need a whole bunch of stuffies. We take the whole basket and just toss it onto the bed. And it's like, here we go. Excellent. Bunch of pillows.
I forgot a couple. I also got the Point Crow plush.
Doodle.
And then they sent me a second one, I guess, because there was like a factory defect with the first one. I couldn't tell the difference. So now I have two. And I got one of the Joe Cat Gobble plushes. Several of my things. And a fan that we met at a convention made and gave me a little red stuffed penguin.
Yes.
So that's still on my shelf of honor.
Yeah.
A lot of extremely cool
stuff. At the same convention got us little finger puppets.
Little finger puppets of ourselves, yeah.
I've got the Indigo and the Ziggy ones sitting on my calendar over there. It's very fun. I don't have as many plushes. When I was a kid, I had like one or two that I really liked, but in my current apartment, in the effort of trying not to carry too much stuff, I didn't really take any from home, so everything I have is more recent acquisitions. There's a little Rocket Raccoon that Blue and Cyan and some friends from college gave me at a very difficult time in my life, and further evidence that I've been on that Guardian shit since back in the day. one of the Joe Cat Gobbos, I have the Wizard one, and I think that's all the plush that's in my apartment. Oh, I have a Blahaj.
Of course you do.
Oh, yes.
I have the big Blahaj. This was an essential purchase when me and my previous roommate were outfitting our apartment. And I kept it when we went our separate ways into different living alone situations. It was completely happy and good. We just moved to different cities. But I won that custody battle.
You didn't take the Blahaj in the divorce?
I got the Blahaj in the divorce. But then when my boyfriend was outfitting his apartment, he bought the mini version of the Blahaj. So when we move in together, we're going to have Blahajes.
Don't talk to me or my son ever again.
Don't talk to me or my son ever again, very much so. But yeah, that's, I think, my plush ratio. I'm nothing against them. I'd love to have more of these squishy guys, but I tend not to pick them up unless there's like a very specific reason or just because I'm trying to avoid cluttering my apartment with too many knickknacks. I'm already hitting about maximum capacity on knickknackage in this place, at least. So we'll see if I gain a second bedroom at any point in my life, if I maybe increase the plush amounts equivalently.
Incredible.
But I think we got time for one last question. I think this will be a nice little short one. This one comes from Obi, son of Obi, to all. Who is physically the strongest out of all of OSP? And I feel like the answer is probably Red, just given...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be.
I don't
personally
feel like
we haven't exactly had a contest of arms recently.
I am terrible at arm wrestling. I don't know what it is mechanically about the way that my body exists, but I have never won an arm wrestling match before. Like, I can do pull-ups and stuff. It's just arm wrestling specifically, that twisting I can't do.
Yeah,
I got weak noodly arms. I statted myself entirely into dexterity, and I have dumped constitution and strength equivalently. I'm a pretender to this title. I think it's Red by a landslide.
Well, all right then.
If it's who'll win in a fight, I'm going to put in a word for myself because of like a dozen years of various martial arts trainings. But if it is raw strength, I'm just assuming Red with like dinosaur dig physicality, and then that's it. That's
Which one of
over.
Us could bench the most? Probably Red.
Potentially. I don't like normal gyms. They're too big and crowded, but I have on occasion
doesn't want to intimidate the
things.
Rest of us with her bulging muscle.
I just, it's more comfy to work out in private. I don't know why anybody goes to a public gym. People are weird. Anyway, I mean, the OSP Battle Royale stats become much more complicated on account of like traps and weapons and stuff like that. But in terms of raw strength, it might be me.
Yeah.
If we can do leg strength, it's almost certainly me. But
I think that counts. I think it's you by a landslide, and I think the rest of us are pretenders to this title.
I have never been strong.
Strong is not a word used to describe Indigo and Blue.
No.
Not in the physical sense.
by default, my favorite way to win.
And now for your favorite part of the podcast, the outro, Red. Sipping from your beverage.
Oh, you caught me mid-sippy. Thank you all so much for listening to the Overly Sarcastic Podcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode, and in 1 week?
Yes.
With a bonus episode for the Percy Jackson and the Olympians. We all watched the show, and we had opinions on it, and we also watched the movies and had opinions on those. I don't think... Oh, yes. PAX East, if you're going to be there, we're also going to be there for at least some of it.
Thursday.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. If you missed any pins, there are going to be pins for screen cleaning. Plushies, I think. We still have some of those.
Yep, still got some plushies.
Yep.
Speaking of plushies, our Artemis and Apollo plushies.
Yes. It's a limited supply thing because it's basically just like, how many do we have in stock? They're there until they are gone. And stay tuned for future months because I just... designed a whole bunch of things that I think you guys might like. I don't know. It's pretty cool.
There's some cool stuff coming.
Yeah. I think that's everything we needed to announce. So, until next time, I have been Red.
I've been Blue.
Oh, and if you're a patron, listen to us hanging out in the After After Show show right now.
Yay.
Which we're about to do, because this has been an Overly Sarcastic Podcast. Okay, bye.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's episode of the Overly Sarcastic Podcast. We'll be back on March 20th with another regular thrilling installment, and on March 13th with our very special Percy Jackson bonus episode. If you miss us before then, be sure to check out Overly Sarcastic Productions on YouTube. Got a question for the pod? Head over to Ask OS Pod on Discord for a chance for your question to be featured in a future episode. If you enjoyed the show, please rate us and leave a review on your preferred podcast platform. And if you really enjoyed the show, consider becoming a patron for even more exclusive benefits.